Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Hello all. Welcome to another episode of Armchair Cricket Podcast, a podcast focusing on test cricket by armchair critics of the game. I'm your host, Ajit. In today's episode, I have a friend of the podcast, well-known cricket blogger. Hello, Aryan. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ajit. How are you?
Well, I'm doing good. A bit hectic with work and other things going on. But otherwise, yeah, more or less, usual introduction to the new year after the holidays and other things. How about you?
Yes, understandable. No, things have been fine here by God's grace. 2023 was a big year professionally. It was a learning curve in terms of enhancing my craft. And I'm looking to keep up the good work in 2024 as well.
Hope so. And well, we wish that you grow from strength to strength. I know you've quite a way. And we hope you carry on the same way. We have quite a few topics to discuss. So I think we can start with the India-Afghanistan T20 series. And I believe one of those matches you even attended in person, right? So let's start off with the first T20I where in Mohali, there is a pattern to the two T20Is. Must be said that, you know, India bowling first, restrict Afghanistan to something they believe is chaseable, and then go ahead and sort of their middle order, a couple of new guys, especially coming into the squad. Get the chase done. So, yeah. First T20I, your impressions?
First of all, as you said, there's been a pool of left-handers that Rahul Dravid said has been crucial from a matchup standpoint. And if you see Rinku Singh, Yashasvi Jaiswal, Tilak Verma, Ishan Kishan, who didn't make himself available for the series, but all these left-handers coming into the middle order add an exuberance to the Indian batting, especially with the Rohit Sharma and Virat Kohli's conundrum going on in the backdrop. But strictly speaking for the first T20I, I think one of the biggest positives that have emerged from these two T20Is is Shivam Dubey's batting and his potential filling in as a like-for-like replacement for Hardik Pandya. I think on a good batting surface with minimal movement up front and negligible spin, Afghanistan didn't really blaze off the blocks because only 33 runs came in the power play for no loss in the first T20I in Mohali. So if you know, they could have pressed the accelerator on a pitch that allowed for natural free-flowing stroke play, it could have been better because it left them 25 to 30 runs short of what could have been a good total on that surface. And India did struggle a bit before, as you said, the youngsters joined in and brought India closer to the target.
So look, let's maybe have a quick chat on that conundrum that you brought up. The Rohit Sharma Kohli conundrum. Is this a step back for India? Maybe not the first time we'll go over such a move by a cricket board, but why did they choose to come back? They had stayed out of the equation for a year almost, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm sure it was them asking, and I remember the chief selector Agarkar flying out to South Africa, sitting with them, having this chat, and so on, right? So the question is this a regressive move considering their age and, you know, also maybe their eventually diminishing returns in all formats?
Yeah, Ajit, so firstly, let's talk about the facts, because Rohit has not had a year in T20 cricket where he has struck at 140 or above since 2018. And Kohli faced 124 balls of spin in the middle overs of the IPL last year for a strike rate of just 110, which is obviously considered ordinary in today's day and age. But I think as things stand, the management has reposed their faith in the adaptability of the senior batters, even though, as you are well aware, the pre-series cricketing discourse revolved around their ouster. And eventually, fans and pundits alike labeled their selection for the Afghanistan T20 as a backward step, as you rightly pointed out. So whatever be the long-term implications of sticking to the old guard, I think there is a conscious effort to nudge the safety-first approach off the table, because it was evident during the Afghanistan series and Rohit looked to impose himself from the word go. It may or may not have paid off, because he fell prey to the ball-watching folly of Shubman Gill in the first T20I and then got bowled in the second one. But there is a conscious effort, and you could make it out from how Kohli went about his business in Indore, because he kind of tore up the old template and came out firing on all cylinders, took Mujibur Rahman alone for 18 off 7 balls. Of course, the Indore pitch is known to be a featherbed and the lightning quick outfield helped him. But the change in batting approach is crystal clear. Now it boils down to execution, because it's not like India have suddenly tried to reinvent the wheel. It has been a work in progress for a long time now, over the last 2-3 seasons. But we have seen the batting suddenly revert to type in global events. Suddenly there's a couple of wickets up front and India go back to their conventional roots, rendering all the planning and speed work that had gone into redefining the methods futile all of a sudden. So I think it's a matter of execution, because this is the last assignment India have before the marquee event, that is the T20 World Cup. And them being selected for this series does imply that they will travel to the ICC trophy. And we can actually hope that Kohli and Rohit's batting styles come out well in sync with how T20 cricket is played in the modern age.
Yeah, I mean, the two ducks for Rohit also doesn't help, because he's a better cricketer when he's relaxed, I think, when he's not thinking too much about how he has been doing this and that. He's usually a better batter, and he's been giving the starts for India in the recent times anyway. When it comes to even tests, right, he's able to give you that slightly turbocharged start. And he did that not very long ago. I guess it's sort of one more tilt at a world trophy. We've discussed, we've heard this all before. But for me, it feels like a little bit of a regressive step, because there are so many people waiting in the wings. Gill, well, he's not been having the best time out of it. So maybe a drop in the second T20 will help him. There is Rituraj Gaikwad. There is Sanju Samson. There are many other people, including Shreyas Iyer, KL Rahul, who've been rested, right? So for me, that felt a bit weird, giving Shreyas Iyer and KL Rahul some time on the bench, Hardik Pandya being injured. You bring these two back, it felt like a terrible stopgap measure, simply because you cannot see India going into the T20 World Cup without Rahul and Iyer, right? But then, what about the people who've been performing well here? I mean, you're asking a bunch of very talented people, 3-4 people whose name you already took, right? Dubey, Verma, Jitesh, Rinku, right? All of these, I somehow think Shubman Gill will make the squad, right? So in that case, even all of these, Washington Sundar, right? Probably these people, I'm thinking maybe one or two of them will only go, because of the other names we just took. And they are poor international quality players. It's not right, I felt, on so many people asking to compete for so few set of slots. It feels a bit weird, but okay. Coming to the results themselves, first of all, from Afghanistan perspective, they'll be a bit disappointed about how the opening or the first top three for us gone. Maybe even in the second T20I, Gulbadin Naib being promoted, making a 50, but still they don't have that the required firepower. Somebody like Rahmanullah Gurbaz, you would expect to be blazing away, right?
And even the failures of Najibullah Zadran to produce that firepower at the back end of the innings hurt them, because I think after Gulbuddin Nayab produced that sprightly 50, nobody really hung around from the batting order to support him, because one or two knocks of 40 odd could have taken Afghanistan to an even better total. Because 172, even though might appear strong and formidable on paper, it is an inadequate total on a surface like Holkar, which obviously offers true bounce and you can hit through the line, which was evident in the way Yashasvi Jaiswal and Shivam Dubey slammed those half centuries at a strike rate of 200.
Right. See, also the way they combated spin. I think Akshar Patel is making a good point. Somebody like Ravi Bishnoi got targeted in both the games. But for me, Washington Sundar, I expected him to do a little bit as well. Maybe he'll do a bit more if given an opportunity in the fourth, so the 30-20A. The pace bowlers have done slightly better. Ashdeep Singh has been very good in both the T20As, Mukesh Kumar as well. Shivam Dubey giving you those 2 to 3 overs or whatever is required, right? Just to give the relief to one of the spinners who might be getting hit a little. The real showman has been Akshar Patel, who's actually tied down Afghanistan in both the games. Nabi did a bit of hitting in the first one, then as we already discussed, Naib did it in the second. But you're right, that little bit of sting in the tail is missing. Is it just Rashid Khan who can also hit a bit, maybe, that could add that firepower, or somebody else? Because I see Najibullah has dropped himself on purpose, I suppose. First of all, he's not the captain in the series, right? Ibrahim Zadran. I don't know if it's again a stopgap measure. It felt like a little bit of a regressive move, if you ask me, from Afghanistan. Your thoughts on these things?
Firstly, speaking about Akshar Patel, I think his bowling has really come of age after the 2023 series, because he was languishing a bit in the ODI aspect, because when there was not help available from the surface, it could just be a case of how Australia go with Ashton Agar, because nothing really happens off the surface because he doesn't turn the ball a mile. So it's nice that he's worked on slowing up the pace and using the box a little more cleverly, because that adds a little string to his bow. And also in the batting department, I think having capable hitters like Akshar Patel and Washington Sundar at number 7 and 8 is providing India's top order batters more freedom to attack, because that could be made out from the way Rohit also swung for the fences from ball one and Virat went about his business. So when Hardik Pandya returns, he will lend even better balance. So I think now the foundation has been laid, and if India are going to stick with Kohli and Rohit, they really should bring their game up to scratch. And also speaking about Afghanistan's bowling attack, I think one of the observations I felt during the second ODI in Indore, I was at the venue and Karim Jannat struck twice in the 13th over to give Afghanistan some respite. And I wondered if Afghanistan could have launched him earlier instead of introducing spin in the power play, because he seemed to be someone who was bowling at a decent click and hit the deck hard. Even rushed Shivam Dubey on the pull with his rapid action. So just underutilizing him, leaving his 2 overs down the plate, didn't quite feel right in a game which seemed to be frenicking along. So I think tactically it was not a sound move. They could have introduced him in the power play and used maybe a couple of more overs of Karim Jannat.
And I also felt, he was not up to it in the field. Somehow his head was somewhere else almost. He was fielding not very well, and that didn't show up nicely. But nonetheless, he's in the team as a bowling all-rounder, and he bats lower down the order. It makes sense that somebody who's clicking, especially when you know things are quickly spiraling out of control, the way Shivam Dubey got going. I mean, Yashasvi Jaiswal is a completely different beast in T20s. The way he bats in ODIs, sorry, the way he bats in tests. You see, it's a complete, like, it's a Jekyll and Hyde sort of a story. But Shivam Dubey has been the revelation so far in the series, as far as India are concerned. Jitesh Sharma has been sort of absent. Even behind the stumps, he's been okay. But I was looking for a bit more. Rinku Singh, not a lot of chances, but he's done what is required. For me, between somebody like Jitesh Sharma and Washington Sundar, I expected them to do a bit more slightly. But outside of that, India will be happy with this, how things have been working out. You'll
Yeah,
see that
definitely.
Arshdeep and Mukesh will make the T20 squad. We know Ravi Bishnoi is probably on the fringes, but he has a chance to push his case also during the IPL, because you know Jadeja will definitely come back, but I'm not sure if Ashwin will get a chance in the T20 squad. So that's where somebody like Washington Sundar, a like for like for Ashwin, right? Though not many people can compensate for that guile that Ashwin has. But Akshar Patel will definitely go. But it'll be all about the pace bowlers as well, because it'll be played on faster, more even pitches, right? So Arshdeep, people like Bumrah and Shami coming back to the equation. So that's the important part. Siraj also has been rested in this series. All three main pacers, you know, knowing the India-England series is around the corner, they have been rested. So, you know, just to round out this topic, because we are talking of Indian cricket and all these names that we mentioned, India have released the squad for the first two tests. Dhruv Jurel gets a call up as a sort of a backup, let's put it like this, right? So the first two England tests, India have a very interesting squad. So Dhruv Jurel, and then, well, Avesh Khan retains his place as the pace backup, right? So for you, any other surprises in the squad?
No, I think it's a fairly well-picked squad, because Jurel recently scored a half century for India A in a four-day first-class fixture against South Africa A in Benoni, and followed it up with a 38-ball 50 to make the headlines in the closing stages of the two-day game against England Lions, which was concluded recently in Ahmedabad. And his knock included 3 sixes and 5 fours. So it's a very handy third keeping option after KL Rahul and KS Bharat, because India have been vying for a wicketkeeper batter who can change the complexion of the game, because that's why Ishan Kishan has been fast-tracked into the Red Ball squad. And, you know, KS Bharat also took the game on in that Border Gavaskar trophy against Australia, slog sweeping Lion. And also, Jurel, having played 15 first-class games, averaging an excellent 47, it's a good pick, I think. He may or may not make the squad, but it's an interesting selection nonetheless. Apart from that, the return of Kuldeep Yadav and Akshar Patel into the test squad, because Kuldeep, on surfaces which can assist spinners and which don't, he is a pretty handy bowler, because he can, you know, create things out of nowhere. He has that guile, that revs on the ball to leave batters in it easy. So I'm quite happy with the selection. On surfaces that do not provide much, for example, in some sessions, Avesh Khan can hit the deck hard and reap extra bounce out of the surface. So India have all bases covered, in my opinion.
Right. So that's the India squad, and it looks, as you say, fairly balanced and a lot to look forward to. The series starts in about 10 days' time. England squad, I don't know if you've had a chance to also remember that, because they announced it well ahead of time, but that's to be expected. For me, one of the talking points is that they're coming just 3 days before the series starts off. No practice games. So something that surprises you, or something that they may have simulated the conditions sort of back home and some other thought process?
Yeah, I was just checking out their Instagram, and they have been arranging a training camp in Abu Dhabi. So you can make out that they are trying to simulate the conditions by preparing ranked earners over there. But for me, the more interesting conversation is hovering around the baseball philosophy, because Ben Stokes gave out a very cool statement that when we beat New Zealand 3-0, the talk was that we can do it against South Africa, Pakistan or Australia. But we've proceeded to make a splash against all those countries. So who knows if we can do it against India also, only time will tell. Because the last time England went to India, they lost 3-1. And Alistair Cook lost 4-0 as captain in 2017. And on the previous two tours, they've by and large stuck to those conventional methods, barring the odd flashes of exuberance, for example, Moeen Ali and Ben Stokes producing centuries, or Kevin Peterson doing it in 2012 in Ahmedabad. They've largely stuck to those orthodox methods, and it hasn't paid off superbly. So Alistair Cook saying that they won't die wondering and they won't have nothing to lose is actually a fairly cool statement. And I think it sets up the inning, sets up the intrigue nicely, because, you know, Indian spinners in their backyard, they're absolutely lethal. They are forces to reckon with. And for a visiting team to come here and say that we'll take them head on, we'll take the bull by the horns, it's a delicious prospect.
Absolutely. And you can expect there'll be some sparks. So for me, the batting of England sort of stacks up beautifully, and they have enough power hitters. They're whatever the proven quantities, Harry Brooks. Some of these, they might be proven outside in the back, in the bass ball, you know, mindset and other things. But when it comes to playing in India, they'll also be here either for the first time or for, you know, relatively new here. So people like Zach Crawley have something to prove. Ben Duckett sort of came out of his funk in India only with England, I remember. Ben Fox is back in the squad. For me, well, the spin department, they don't stack up. Very few spinners, very few spinning contingents out there will match Ashwin, Jadeja and so on. But Jack Leach will be their lead spinner, of course. But then what do you make of the backup in terms of Rehan Ahmed, Shoaib Bashir and Tom Hartley?
I think I read a bit about Shoaib Bashir because he is a new kid on the block. And England seemed to have spotted something special in him because England, the new selection panel, as you can see, they are not reliant on stats and score sheets per se. They look for that X factor in a player, and Shoaib Bashir bowling in the county circuit has impressed Rob Key and his ilk with the guile, with the variations, with the way he uses the angles. And obviously, he is a tall guy, a beanpole of a spinner. So he extracts that bounce off the deck, which can come handy on Indian surfaces with the short leg and silly point. So I like how the interesting selection processes have panned out. And it was, as you rightly mentioned out, quite a long back while when they announced the squad. So Indian team have announced theirs recently. I'm really looking forward to the contest, and I hope to travel to one of the games, probably in Ranchi or Rajkot, to catch the action live.
Lovely to hear that. Because, see, for me, Leach and Hartley are sort of like for likes. The only X factor is Rehan Ahmed, but he's sort of shaping up well in international cricket. So I'm really looking forward to how he'll do in helpful conditions.
Yeah.
I'm just worried if Jack Leach and or Tom Hartley, I know Jack Leach will probably start with Rehan Ahmed. I don't expect them to go with three spinners, irrespective of the conditions, frankly. The way India have stacked their squad, you'll see probably three spinners. But the other team, we don't expect them to have three spinners. But we'll see how that goes. Because Joe Root is there, right? Who was sort of a backup there.
Yeah.
So they'll go with two spinners, and then Joe Root will be the off-break variety. Whereas Shoaib, he might sort of come into it later in the series. It's a five-match series after all. So I'm looking forward to all of that. Somehow still think it'll be all on how the spinning contingents perform. But they also have a couple of surprise pacemen, right? Mark Wood, you'd never know what he's going to deliver. And Gus Atkinson, probably. Because James Anderson will start, I think. But he'll not play five tests, for sure not. So then, because Ben Stokes is also not going to bowl, you would expect maybe not in every game at least. So then it'll all fall on the likes of Ollie Robinson. And, you know, the spinners. So for me, because Anderson, Wood, and even Atkinson, if they play, they'll be used very sparingly in small bursts. Then it'll be Ollie Robinson carrying the load along with people like Leach, mainly to start off. Right? So there, I think they may have a little bit of a issue if they can't get breakthroughs as soon as they would like. Because if you remember in the previous tour, I think India had sort of given them the taste of air quotes bass ball, where I think they had made 500 odd, India went on to make 700 odd, something like this, and then still beat them in that crazy, crazy game, right? So almost like what Pakistan did to, or England did to Pakistan. So, so I don't know if they'll be able to turn the tables here when they visit India. It's a slightly different prospect, simply because of one, the quality of batters and the spinners, but a lot to look forward to.
Yeah, one of the factors that augurs well when you speak about the pacers is that those on the fringes like Gus Atkinson, he took 20 impressive wickets at an average of 20 in 5 games this year to help Surrey win the county championship. And he was a member of England's team during the recent ODI World Cup in India. So he has miles under his legs as far as bowling in India is concerned, because at times you see that teams, when they just land on overseas shores, they can be found wanting in terms of the lengths they want to hit, because it happened to India in Centurion. Their lengths were not quite in the 6 to 8 meter zone, as you like They were floating deliveries up. They were bowling far too wide. And then you saw a complete 360 degree turnaround in Newlands, where they were right on the money from the word go. And it just reflected into the way the game panned out, because it was the shortest completed test in history. So it's good that even guys like Hartley and Bashir have been training in the UAE with the England Lions team. So I'm really looking forward to how the spinners perform. And one of the crucial ingredients of success as far as bowling is concerned is the proactive captaincy. Because as we were talking off the record, someone like Smith standing in for Pat Cummins in Indore and pushing Cheteshwar Pujara into a corner with a 6-3 field in Indore and eventually dismissing him with that stranglehold. So it's very important for captains to be proactive in India. And it has been a hallmark of baseball. It's a very limiting definition to restrict it to just batting, because it applies to bowling enterprise, fielding and their captaincy tactics. So it'll be very interesting to see how the bowlers are rotated, how the field placements are designed to, you know, make the batters fall. It would be a very enticing prospect. And another thing that I want to add is that, not to undermine Kevin Peterson's 186 in Mumbai, but at that point, if you see the Indian spinners, Harbhajan Singh, Pragyan Ojha, these were essentially one-trick ponies. But nowadays, with Ashwin having developed the carom ball, the sliders, and the myriad variations, it will be all the more difficult to execute those firebrand cricketing shots, right?
Absolutely. But you know, when it comes to people like Bairstow and Stokes, you don't write them off. I mean,
yeah, definitely.
I'm expecting they'll make at least one impact each, in maybe more than one in these tests, and that'll probably also determine how the game will go. But you know, is India having their own answer to baseball? Simply because Shreyas Iyer said leaving the ball bores him. So
yeah, definitely.
He made run a ball 48, and he's in the squad. He's probably a starter as well, as far as India are concerned. So right. India also will come up with a little bit of a fight back, because KL Rahul will probably look to be steady, while it'll all depend on how Kohli, Iyer, and Rahul, right? And Rohit Sharma, I expect, will remain positive. And Gill, number three, will have something to prove as to, you know, saying I'm the next guy for the spot in all formats and so on. So I'm looking forward to all of these.
Yeah, as you speak of Gill, a very interesting anecdote comes to my mind. This was during the Border Gavaskar Trophy, the previous one. And Gill had been stumped trying to hit Nathan Lyon down the ground in one of the games. And obviously, as a batter, when you suffer that kind of a dismissal, the initial reaction is to go into your shell in the next innings and not try something of that sort again. But it was a peek into how the modern day batter operates, that as soon as Nathan Lyon was introduced into the attack, Gill stepped down the track, put on his dancing shoes and whacked him down the ground.
Gill, right, it's been a little bit of a weird thing for me, because he looks always in touch. He looks beautifully composed, and only thing that missing is somehow he gives his wicket away.
Yeah.
And he'll always be scoring well in any format of the game. I mentioned this, I think, in the previous episode when we discussed his performances in South Africa. He never looked out of form, so to say.
Yeah.
Just that against the run of play, he gets dismissed. Same in the second T20A and so on.
Yeah.
But okay, we'll see if... first T20A, sorry. We'll see if...
Sometimes, Ajit, when you're supremely talented, it is also an embarrassment of riches, because you have two scoring shots per one particular delivery.
Yeah, maybe to pick which one is the way, right? As
correct,
Tendulkar
yeah.
once said. I mean, that's what made him Tendulkar. But walking away from that, so let's have a quick chat on this other international series that we see, Pakistan, New Zealand, where the two T20As have unfolded in between the episodes. So Pakistan, maybe a little disappointing, do you think? Or you expected this is how things would go for them?
I think considering the dimensions of the New Zealand venues, huge totals were on the board, and it has proved to be the case, because New Zealand have posted huge totals in both the games, and now they are leading the series 2-0. It was obviously going to be a slightly bumpy transition, because Shaheen Afridi has taken over the reins from Babar Azam, who has now been freed up entirely, with Mohammad Rizwan being the deputy. So obviously I'm not jumping to judge as of now, because obviously when a new captain is handed out the reins, it takes a while to gel with all the guys in a new capacity and take stock of how the team will shape up. But I think they should perform slightly better in the remaining games.
So both are, of course, chasers, and you would expect the stronger team will want to chase. But in this case, New Zealand have chosen to bat, and there's nothing wrong there simply because their top order clicked in both the games. Finn Allen giving them a good start. For me, one of the concerns is Devon Conway, but in the rest of the top order, maybe Glenn Phillips needs a bit more time in the middle, but the rest of them are fine, I thought. And of course, there is this talking point of Kane Williamson retiring hurt and not being available for the rest of the series. Is he pushing his body too much? Maybe he should stick to one format, do you think? The best one, that is.
Test cricket, obviously. Yeah, it was a very unfortunate thing for him to injure his ankle, I think, during the IPL because he was attempting for a catch on the boundary line. And that probably induced the chain reaction from which he had to spend a lot of time on the treatment table. But it was good to see him score some runs out there. His 50 and Daryl Mitchell's half century powering New Zealand to a gigantic 226. But yeah, I do think that that's how world cricket is shaping along with players prioritizing formats. And a very interesting statement was given out by De Kock because he said that when you are approaching 32, 34, when you're on the wrong side of 30s, it's that final slab, a window of opportunity to have your final top up as a franchise cricketer. So he doesn't want to let loose of that opportunity. So it's quite fascinating how the dynamics are shaping up with all these leagues coming up around the world. And we've already seen the ripple effects of South Africa prioritizing SA20 over the international side that was sent to New Zealand. So, yeah.
I don't know if it's him trying to really extend his T20 international circuit career or so on. I'm more worried about this guy being a test match winner. We saw the immediate impact he brings to the squad when he's in the team, the test match team. He's able to score those important runs. He scored another 100 in the previous series where he won the game, or he set up the series and so on. So when you look at all that, I mean, he's more important as a test match winner. And I dare say his body, given his hamstring troubles and so on,
Yeah, an elbow
might
as well.
not really correct, right? Elbow and hamstring, it's a known issue. Then,
Yeah.
in theory, a test match is more demanding than a T20A. But apparently, for him, the way he sets himself up, maybe he's in a better position to play test matches than T20A, as you know, as contrasting as that might sound. But
Correct, correct.
nonetheless, I think for a test match winner, I think he should still focus on winning test matches in the remaining amount of time because I don't see him really coming to play this T20A circuit or T20 circuit, must say, once his retirement happens or when he's close to the retirement. For him, he's also the respect he has earned winning test matches and sort of playing those tough innings, right? For me, he's one of those people who are like Pujara, who's adapted to the shorter formats rather than the other way, not like a David Warner or somebody, right? So in this case, him, people even like Kohli, I dare say, they can actually look at extending their longer format presence because they are test match winners. And that is what probably is the most satisfying. I don't know if I'm right when I judge it like this, but probably the most satisfying as a cricketer as well. So something to see there.
But I think something I want to add to this debate is that this debate, when you're talking outside the big three, that is India, England, and Australia, this debate is heavily influenced by finances as well. Because someone like Virat Kohli can choose to sit out an IPL, but I'm not sure if like Kane Williamson or how the New Zealand pay structure stacks up. But other teams have to rely on the shorter format games as well to, keep their coffers full.
No, but I think the individual beneficiary is the important point there rather than boards getting much out of it. So it's always an individual because otherwise people like Quinton de Kock would never have been allowed to walk away, right? Even though because he plays SA T20 right there, but he will not play the national team. It's not the boards, but the individual who takes these calls and also is benefiting from it. And from that perspective, I think Kane Williamson, I read in the air, so to say, that he might call time on one or two of the formats just to make it happen that he plays better in the longest format. So I'm looking forward to how that goes. But coming to the on-field results from a Pakistan perspective, look, they have also tried to give chances to some new people because it also might be the thought of the new captain, right? Abbas Afridi has come in. Amir Jamal, who's been doing well on the Antipodean tour, has continued. But
Superbly.
Unfortunately, Amir Jamal, not much of a result in the T20A so far, but it's a five-match series. Let's see if he'll get more chances. Shaheen Shah Afridi himself, at least he's beginning to take wickets again, but that swing, that dangerous swing that we usually associate with him is not to be seen. Not in tests. T20A is very tough to judge that. Haris Rauf has come back to the squad. But you would expect a little bit more from the Pakistan bowling lineup because Usama Mir also not really impressive. Shadab is not available here by the looks of it. So all of this, when you see, I think they may have to then also say, did they have the best bowling squad? Because the batting we know has been under fire, no doubt.
Yeah.
Babar Azam hitting some runs. Fakhar Zaman making some runs. Iftikhar Ahmed not really... The lower middle order, the finishers are the ones that are having the issue. Iftikhar, Azam, maybe Shaheen Shah Afridi if he considers himself a finisher these days. But also right up top, Saim Ayub will play only one way. It's very clear. Right? He'll be the next big hitter potentially if he clicks. Mohammad Rizwan batting up top has not yet paid off. He got them off to a quick start in the first T20A, but they couldn't convert it because the first T20A was a huge total. Second one, again, 1-6 and out. So there, I think, having somebody like Fakhar Zaman in the middle order instead of just to have him open because they want to accommodate Rizwan because he's also the vice-captain, right? So it's a very tough call, I suppose. But I think Pakistan are not heading the right way when they keep both Babar and Rizwan in the T20A 11. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I think the point you made about Pakistan being magnificent in parts during the bowling was a key one because in the second T20I, the victory was fashioned obviously by a blazing 41 ball 74 from Finn Allen. And it seemed as if New Zealand would again go on to post a total in excess of 200. But from there to have restricted the host under 200 and then threatened to chase it down via the 87 run stand between Babar Azam and Fakhar Zaman. So yeah, Pakistan have been playing well in parts, but it hasn't been a coordinated team effort so far. And with the series on the line, Pakistan have their task cut out because the hosts have only lost twice in 12 games in Hamilton since 2008.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough one to overturn because you would expect it'll again be a high-scoring game. Whoever will bat first will look to put enough runs on board so that they're comfortably going to have at least 20-30 runs in the bank, let's just say, for enforcing a win.
Before we move on to the next topic, a word of appreciation, Ajit, for Tim Southee, who continues to sharpen his tools, becoming the only player to take 150 wickets in T20Is.
Absolutely. You would think, again, one of those people who you would think would be perfect fit for test matches, the pace at which he bowls, the line's length. He's continued to reinvent himself, right?
Yeah.
And to show up like this and to do what he's been doing, he's even the test match captain, so you'd think his focus may have shifted a little. But no, he's their most successful T20A bowler as well. And he shows again and again, it's not about pace, it's about the guile with which you bowl, right? So it's very nice to see that. No. So, yeah, indeed, congratulations to Tim Southee as well with that small milestone. But as you said, I find it very tough to see how Pakistan might turn this around. But it's Pakistan, right? You never write them off. That's why we watch Pakistan games. So, looking forward to that.
Mercurial as a team.
Right? Because this is exactly what they need. Because I have spoken like this, Mohammad Rizwan will come score a 60 of 28 balls next game and they'll win the match and so on. But let's see. Also, it might be the toss. They might do well if they bat once first. So let's see how that goes. Moving on to the Sri Lanka-Zimbabwe series. The ODI series has happened in the meantime and the first T20A. I mean, Zimbabwe's performance in the ODI is a little disappointing for you considering how they did in the previous tour.
Yeah, I think they have been underperforming a little. But it was nice to catch up a little on the Sri Lanka-Zimbabwe games. Although my job with Gorilla Cricket entails covering the Indian team at large, but I've been keeping a tab on the results. I think rain had the final say in the first ODI, the series opener, but we still got to witness a brilliant century from Charit Asalanka. I think Sri Lanka were languishing at 1.125 for 4 and then he took them to 273. Madhushanka struck twice early before weather obviously played spoil sport. And in the second ODI, A fabulous knock from Janith Lianage. I hope I'm pronouncing it right because Sri Lankan names are a little crazy that wise. And just his second ODI and chasing 209, the Islanders are obviously tottering at 53 for 4. And for him to then lead the rear guard along with the tail was good to watch. And I think Zimbabwe had the game in the bag through Richard Angarawa's maiden 5-wicket haul, but weren't able to close out and ended up suffering a heartbreak.
Absolutely. Little bit of awareness, I thought, in that game, because see, they had the wickets right up front. It was a low scoring game, and this guy playing his first series really stepped up. So the thing about Sri Lankan cricket is they always throw up these mercurial players. There are, of course, long lasting, long or long shining, bright shining stars like Sangakkara, Jayawardena, Jayasurya, but you also have these people who come in and who are really bright for a short period of time. Charit Asalanka is stepping up to be the bright shining star for a, let's see if a short term or a long term, because he's played a couple of exceptional knocks in limited overs cricket recently. That 100, what you said, right? And if Raza doesn't perform, Zimbabwe, they are in trouble. I mean, that's the first thing they have to change, because I don't know how much of a force people like Craig Irwin and even Ryan Burrell remain, because Ryan Burrell always on and off. It all falls on the shoulders of Sikandar Raza, and they're trying different players. They're trying Clive Madande, Faraz Akram, people, the new opening pair, for example, in ODIs, Milton Shumba. So some of these people have to, at some point in time, have that breakthrough where they're able to combat and make those runs. I don't see that yet. So for me, the bowling, Engarawa, Blessing Mojarabani, really good, but not a lot to support them. It comes back again on Sikandar Raza. So for me, that's the real problem.
Ajit, just going back to the point you made about Sri Lanka producing these volatile cricketers who have spurts of brilliance, I think I read an incredible book by Nathan Lehman and Ben Jones, are hitting against spin. And it talked about a very interesting fact that countries like India, which have a large talent pool, they focus more on orthodoxy and conventionalism, trying to make cricketers as close to the mold of perfection as possible because they have a large sample size to choose from, so they can filter out those who don't fit into that criterion. But countries like Sri Lanka, which do not have a massive population and obviously have little concentrations of cricket, they tend to force grow cricketers who have this mercurial skill or who can change the complexion of the game in an inning or with a small spell. So it was a very interesting facet of how Sri Lanka or Pakistan, for example, continue to produce these unpredictable cricketers who may be ruling the roost one day and come a cropper the next.
That's the thing, right? You focus on results then, and you see who can give you that result at that point in time. And then what you said, there's no longevity is not always the concern at the start. Some cricketers still make it in both countries. Also, for example, Pakistan's cricket is at least was based on a similar approach for a long time. Now I guess they are trying to build a system where people are sort of already bred from a young age to be more conventional, but still keeping that little bit of mercurialness right there, right? But look at New Zealand, just a small counterpoint to that same approach. Not a big pool of players, but they still churn out those consistent sort of stars who are very much based in orthodoxy, if I may say like that, right? But then, of course, you'll have the Glenn Phillips. Of course, you'll have people, Conways, who sort of, you know, whose origin may be from elsewhere, but it really doesn't matter because they fit into that mold right away.
Correct.
And then you have even cricketers like Bolt, Saudi, who are, you should look at them as, in theory, purely conventional cricketers, right? But nonetheless, they're able to break out of that and shine. So,
Yeah, it's basically a trickle-down effect from the history and subtext of how you've performed over the years, which instills that culture. Speaking of the third ODI, Vanindu Hasaranga, who recently announced his retirement from Test cricket, just four caps
right.
at 26 years of age, with an eye on prolonging his limited overs career. The decision seems to be serving its purpose as he returned like 7 for 19 in the final ODI. Bowled out for 96 in 22.5 over Zimbabwe, and which is now the record for the fifth best men's ODI bowling figures.
Absolutely. So that caught us all by a little bit of surprise. But if you look back at it, really, you'll say, okay, we may have seen that coming. Same like Henrik Larsson sort of agreeing to not play tests anymore because it doesn't suit him. But that is a different age group of player. And he's closer to the retirement than Hasaranga. But it's you can see that his innovations are more sort of geared towards people who are going to try and hit him.
Yeah,
you don't see that orthodoxy in his bowling, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't see that loop, the flight, the sort of trying to beat a more orthodox technique, but it's more geared towards trying to beat somebody with that minimal amount of turn that is effective. You saw most of the dismissals were people bowled or LBW, right? So of course he has the skill if he wants to build it up, but then it takes a certain amount of one thought process, but also certain amount of training to go back to that basic orthodoxy that will give you wickets in all formats, so to say. Yeah. But this one is more geared towards T20s and limited overs. And it looked like Zimbabwe were playing a T20. I don't know what they were doing. It was a stop-start game, of course. It was not easy to bat with all that happening. But from 43 for Nolas to be 96 all out, you would see that they could have done better. Again, one person fails, the team fails, sort of. Yeah. But the one real cracker of a game they produced was in the T20A, right? And there again, I thought 7 balls, 20 runs to get. 2 set batters or not, that is really up against it. 3 runs a ball, you would have to say, is really up against it, right? Yeah. From that point in time, again, it's again those two bowlers, Engarawa and Blessing Musarabani, you would expect they would take their team home. That's just probably maturity, lack of maturity there, that they ended up bowling length balls. They were all length balls that got hit all over the place. Mm-hmm. Angelo Matthews is, you know when you're defending 16 in the last over, Blessing Musarabani, you think all you need to do is the first 2 balls, you need to not let the batsman hit a boundary. Then the rest of it, he's now pushed into a corner, whoever the batsman on the strike is. That's where they failed, I thought, where first ball went for a 4, where he's waiting for a length ball and he's just hitting you back over your head.
Yeah.
Whereas the field you see is perfectly set for either a leg side ball into his pads or a yorker on his pads, something like this, because the mid-off is up. So this sort of awareness or lack of communication, I don't know what it was, because you saw Sikandar Raza, who's the captain in the T20As, gesticulating and sort of trying to tell his bowler where he needs him to bowl, but that never happened. Right? Yeah. And they got a wicket, but then Chamira, the fast bowler, hit one right behind the keeper. Again, 6 of 2 or so, something like that. You don't know where it'll go, but the ball went straight behind the keeper. Something for which you can't set the field. They were a bit unlucky, but then they didn't help themselves. That was the thing for me. So again, from where they were even 2-3 years ago, the way they were able to punch to where they suddenly have found themselves, I'm really worried about Zimbabwe cricket. That's the one point I had, because we talked about these different sorts of mindsets when it comes to the management and what sort of players they are trying to bring up. Orthodoxy versus this mercurial nature. You don't see either in Zimbabwean cricket.
Yeah,
I don't know if their first-class setup is up to it in terms of competitiveness. Right? We recently saw somebody hit a 400 there. So that's good. Breaking all sorts of records in the first-class setup in Zimbabwe. Nonetheless, a 300. I did not mean a 400, but a 300. But still, the bedrock of your, the training, how the players are brought up. I mean, just as a counterpoint, somebody in Cooch Behar Trophy hit a 400, right? Yeah. A youngster in Prakar Chaturvedi, he hit a 400 in the final. So it's not 300, 400. These are not the numbers. It's whom you're competing against.
Yeah.
Because these same players will be your first-class opposition when you come out of age group cricket. And then eventually, similar sort of people will also be available at the international cricket, because we've heard of it time and time again, where even people who've been sort of bashing about all the bowlers they can find, for example, batters, right? In domestic cricket, the moment they come to international cricket, they're like, really? Because it takes them so much by surprise.
Yeah.
And we know enough stars who've been what we talk of as, domestic giants, not being really able to convert, be it great, people of yesteryears, right? So, for some people, it might be mindset, but for many other people, they just don't have that setup where they are used to facing bowling of that quality.
Correct. That's a beautiful explanation.
So for me, that's the real problem for Zimbabwe, because at least in the shortest format, you would expect that they would surprise a team or two. If they cannot, I don't know if what hope we should hold out for the ODIs and tests. So a lot to be discussed there.
Zoning in on Angelo Matthews for a second.
All right.
Both of us discussed at the start of the recording that how the Indian selectors have prioritized wealth of experience and temperamental fortitude when it comes to Kohli and Rohit being given an extended run. Even though they were not a feature of the Indian T20 sides for the last year or so, but they've been brought back into the fold. A similar case is unfolding with Angelo Matthews because it was his first T20 outing in almost 3 years. And he obviously fared well, 46 of 38. There have been allegations of personal agendas dominating the selector's judgment for him not being part of the T20 World Cups despite performing well in the LPL, that is Lanka Premier League seasons. So what is your overall assessment of that? Should you believe that he can be a part of the T20 World Cup coming up? Because he is obviously an experienced campaigner and there is this constant debate of whether you should entrust too much faith into a youth-oriented team because they tend to crackle when the tough situations arise.
Well, look, he's a proven performer at the top level. Mm. But his returns in the limited overs have not been what they should be, frankly. Mm. I think he may have gotten a new lease of life with his close friend, potentially, Upul Taranga being the head of selectors. Mm-hmm. So maybe he's using that, but for me, it again boils down to the group of people they have that they can get their hands on as selectors, right? Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if there are many other good finishers. Probably people like Kusal Pereira, and they have not taken the chances that have come their way. Even Kusal Mendes is finally now stepping up.
Yeah.
You have now people like Charita Salanka. Janit Lianaga is too new. But in any case, there are many names like that. Even Dasun Shanaka, you can say the same thing. He was sort of completely out of the squad, no longer the captain and so on. But I think they have been given one more chance to see if, as you say, if they can translate that performances in LPL and other things to the next level.
Yeah.
And in this game, the first T20, both of them did, Shanaka and Angelo Matthews was the man of the match, right? And for me, it might seem as a regressive move in many other cricketing teams and cultures. In Sri Lanka, I don't think it is, simply because the pool of players that are available to them might not be that big.
Yeah.
So in this case, well, it might be a legitimate experiment in a T20 World Cup year.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that was the Zimbabwe-Sri Lanka series. Now, if we quickly go back to the women's last two T20s, India-Australia. So India sort of punched okay-ish in the ODIs as well. They, I thought, were a little lackluster, but at least they won a game. But what happened in the T20s for a 3-0 clean sweep?
Yeah. So the major takeaways for me, obviously, Australia women clean swept the ODIs and won the T20I series 2-1. So that is 5 victories from 6 wild ball games. And the major takeaways for me was the form of Harmanpreet Kaur and Smriti Mandhana. Big runs eluded both the senior batters. And Deepthi Sharma's scoring rate at number 6 came under the scanner because her slow tempo towards the back end robbed a power hitter like Pooja Vastrakar of the bandwidth to create more of an impact as India's designated finisher. In the bowling department, I think with India moving on from the likes of Shikha Pandey and Jhulan Goswami, Renuka Singh has cemented a spot as the frontline fast bowler with obviously Pooja Vastrakar sharing the new ball. From the fresh faces, Titas Sadhu, who starred at the inaugural Under-19 World Cup, has grabbed an opportunity with both hands, and so has Shreyanka Patil. She transitioned smoothly after impressing in WPL 23. She showed maturity beyond her years on ODI debut, returning 1 for 43 with the wicket of top scorer Phoebe Leachfield. This was the game on the 30th of December in Wankhede. And I was really impressed to see the way she went about her business using pace to her advantage on a surface that does favor the batters, how she slowed up and down, and how she used the box, just going wide of the crease, coming towards the umpire, and just trying to create different angles, different trajectories to spin a web around the Australian batters. And it was heartening to see even the likes of Elise Perry, Alisa Healy, and Talia McGrath, who has been Australia's standout batter on this tour, not being able to really take the attack to a young spinner bowling in her maiden ODI game. It was amazing to see how the WPL has given wings to these young cricketers and now they're industry ready, so to say.
Yeah, indeed. So first of all, thanks for correcting me. I got the results of the ODIs and the T20Is the other way around. But look, for me, the real problem was the top order, the top four of Indian women's batting, because you need better than, I don't know, 70 for four, right? In both the games. So against this Australian team, if you cannot top 150, 160, even 170 and so on, they'll not even be challenged, I think.
Yeah.
That's where they are in their mindset and their preparation. And the top four, you have to make the most of the runs. We can talk of Richa Ghosh, Deepthi Sharma, Pooja Vastrakar and so on. But the most of the balls have to be faced by the top four. And they have to make sure they bat into the 15th over and have a run rate of about 7 or 8. This is a known thing when it comes to T20s.
Yeah.
That's where I think the Indian batting really failed them. And in both the games, they were only 140s and 130s, right? So that's not going to be enough. So that was the real problem, as far as I'm concerned. And that's where we really, I think, should focus on, simply because the bowling was okay.
Yeah.
They did their bit. They tried to stretch the total to as far as possible, stretching the Australian team into the 18, 19th overs. But look at their top order. On the other hand, Alyssa Healy, Beth Mooney making runs, right?
Yeah.
And then Talia McGrath or Elissa Perry following up immediately. There, the game finishes for me.
Yeah.
Right. Phoebe Litchfield, who's really a breakout star as far as I'm concerned on this tour, she bats in the middle order in the limited overs games, and she didn't even have to do much in both the games. And bowlers, I would say, they did their best to stretch a game that was already sort of in trouble. Right.
Yeah.
Harmanpreet, the entire tour, except for one innings, I think in tests, I think she couldn't do much.
Yeah.
So I don't know if age finally might be catching up with her. I know it's not a nice thing to say, but we'll have to think about it. I'm sure the Indian selectors are already looking about it. Even as fans, you say, where is she heading from here? Is it going to be the T20A circuit? Because I've not seen Harmanpreet play that sort of an innings in more than a year or so, where you would have that one or two real breathtaking innings from her every year, and a lot of consistent runs. That's slowly being going down. So I'm a little worried there as well.
Yeah.
This was the real test, you know, Australia coming to your shores, the real team to beat. Having beaten them in tests, to flatter in this way and then deceive in the limited overs was a little disappointing as an India fan. But let's see if they're able to pick themselves up going further.
Yeah.
And they also have a WIPL to look forward to, plenty of good cricket that we'll get to see from Indian women players.
Yeah, you spoke about the promotion of Richa Ghosh to the top of the order. Yeah, Amol Mazumdar has been backing that move as something that can be pulled off. And I completely agree to the point that your top four should contribute significantly, because if you just put it on a pedestal with how Australia went about in the ODI series opener. So, India post 282 and even managed to dismiss Alyssa Healy early with Sneha Rana taking a brilliant catch in the gully region. And from there onwards, the top three just continue to boss the attack and Australia cruise home, with India waiting for a mistake from the opposition in the chase, a short way to lose games of cricket. So just adding to that run of play, I think India would do well to introduce a leg spinner, mystery spinner, or a genuine quick. You know, you could produce those breakthroughs when runs come thick and fast on the placid pitch, because India is also ruining the skill and smarts of Jhulan Goswami in the middle phase. And I think the captaincy tends to be a little laid back when batters get set. So a little bit more proactivity. And obviously, as you speak, that the selectors are mulling over the options. I think we might see a wind of change in the Indian women's setup in the next coming months.
All right. Let's see how the team shapes up after the WIPL.
Yeah.
Now, moving off the cricket field onto some other interesting news. So the Australian team that is ready to take on a very interesting looking West Indian team, right, in tests. Smith will open and Green will slot in at number four. So that's the first thing. Now that, you know, Warner has walked off into the sunset, there was always going to be a chance that a proper opener, Cam Bancroft, Marcus Harris, one of these people might come in. But they have actually got a very persuasive Smith, actually, who's sort of, who wants more, apparently, who wants to do something more. He was sort of not feeling up to it, I suppose. He's done enough in the middle order. He thought, I'll go up the order. Now, being an opener is a real specialist job for me, with the new ball or against the new ball, I think. And that's a very interesting challenge that Smith has opted for. And when it comes to the rest of the 11 for Australia. There may be some experimental things we know. So in this case, your thoughts on, first of all, the Australian squad?
Yeah, first of all, when you talk about the exclusion of Cam Bancroft, it was understandable why he was miffed, because he was the leading run scorer in the Sheffield Shield for the past two seasons. And Victorian opener Marcus Harris was also left out. He appeared to be the man most likely to fill the Warner-sized hole, but both were overlooked. And you used a very key word that is persuasive for Smith pushing his case to open, because even the leadership group, Pat Cummins, was opposite when it came to pushing Smith up the order. And he was content with the champion batter's output at number four, didn't really want to shuffle the deck chairs. But Smith seems to have had his way, and now he's opening the batting. So it'll be good to see how he goes about his new role. He said that he doesn't like to wait a lot. So one box is ticked for now.
Right. Cummins did come out and say the test match futures of these other cricketers doesn't have to be getting affected because of that.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to hear that, but here is an opportunity where people like Cam Bancroft or Marcus Harris have been doing the rounds, scoring the runs. Smith may want a different challenge, but you know, in the longer term, it's a really tough equation, because what about Stuart Law and other people, you'll ask.
Sorry.
In that golden era against the middle order batting in Australia. But this is a makeshift opener at the end of the day. There, Stuart Law or somebody was kept out, even Darren Lehman for some years, because these people are all middle order players, and there are enough middle order batsmen there. You can also talk of the illustrious four in Indian middle order and so on. So, but when it comes to opener, I somehow still think it's a very specialized job. You need to be doing it for a decade or so from your developmental age.
The muscle memory, yeah, correct.
Right? But Smith being Smith, you will never write him off. Right?
Yeah.
But for me, that felt like an interesting approach.
Yeah, and just to weigh it up with the conversation you brought up about not sending the right message down the domestic circuit, it has also happened with the likes of Abhimanyu Iswaran, Priyank Panchal, Sarfaraz Khan in the Indian domestic circuit. Because when you fast track guys with wide ball pedigree, Yashasvi, Tilak Verma, and Ishan Kishan, Surya Kumar Yadav over those who have been churning out tons of runs in the domestic arena, it is a tough pill to swallow.
Correct. I mean, somebody like Sarfaraz Khan, he should have debuted in that series where Surya debuted. But anyway, that's another story.
Yeah.
Openers, I see some leeway, because Shubman Gill can play at three. He's an opener. So he was sort of finding his feet. Mm. And then Yashasvi Jaiswal, I think the way he's shown himself in the longer formats, you can see a complete, as I said, Jekyll and Hyde sort of an approach. So apparently he's still a good longer format opener. But here it's a typical number four, sort of the mainstay of your lineup coming up to bat at number one. And Usman Khwaja is also not very far away from retirement. He's 36 plus. You'll see him hang up his boots in a season or two. So those things are going to be interesting, how they'll manage. Because Matt Renshaw is in the squad as a cover for Australia, right?
Mm.
And Cameron Green, they want to desperately induct him into longer format somehow back in, because he's seen as the future of Australian cricket, potentially a future captain and so on.
Yeah.
And as a backup, Mitchell Marsh will have his time, but Cameron Green has the time on his side as well. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
So the rest of the squad is not really surprising. So Stark, Hazelwood and Boland to back up Cummins. So I expected one or two of these to maybe rested, but they've chosen to play. So that's good to see as well.
Yeah.
Because what that gives me is a fear for this West Indian team, because they've chosen a relatively new team. You have Craig Brathwaite, sort of, who's been here for a decade or so. But the rest of the top order, Kirk McKenzie, Ali Katanaze, right, Justin Greaves, you are a bit worried about it. Tagnar and Chandrapal is still an unproven quantity at the top level. Then a lot of onus falls on the keeper batter. This is because many of the regulars have made themselves unavailable for one reason or the other in West Indies. Let's not go there. That's a too deep discussion. But how do you see whether this West Indian team will be even able to punch in the couple of sessions, and then maybe a day or two they fall away? Or do you really see them surprising this Australian team?
Firstly, Ajit, do you think having a full strength squad as Australia have, do you think it could be a measure to maximize the WTC advantage? Because we know that it can be a tall order once things reach the business end of the tournament.
Hmm. I think so.
with teams really jostling for competition in that middle table. So when teams sense blood, they go all in and try and maximize their advantage.
Why not? Look, you are playing at home, you're playing to your advantage, right? The team coming to tour you has sent a weakened squad. It's not your fault. The same
Correct.
when it comes to New Zealand later when they take on South Africa, I suppose.
Definitely, yeah.
There is a clear price to be had in 2 years' time where you get to go to a finals to play a potential trophy final, right? So
Exactly my point, yeah.
it's up to the team that's coming to also be aware of it.
Yeah.
If they choose to prioritize another format or another tournament or T20s in general, then again, who is to be blamed is a question. But in some cases, the board's hand might be forced in West Indies in this case
Yeah.
specifically, right? So how do you handle it? Well, can you build the breadth like a team like India or England that can field two squads at the same time, even Australia and South Africa probably, but maybe not. So in that case, one of their formats will suffer. But I'm sorry to say it's the test match format.
Yeah.
But clearly, T20 is the money that it brings in has slightly better, let's say, attraction to players
Yeah.
than the longer slog where at the end of 5 days, you even might shake hands as a draw, right? This is unfortunately how the modern day is shaping up when it comes to outlook on cricket. But I was a little disappointed when I saw Kyle Myers or Jason Holder not making themselves available, whom I thought were both very good test match players, right? And somebody like Hetmyer falling away and not even being able to keep his slot in the limited overs
Yeah.
teams. So all that is a bit disappointing if you're a West Indian fan.
Yeah, a very interesting statement came from Mark Butcher in this regard. He said that one of the things that made this even more inevitable is that WTC was something that was done to try and salvage Test cricket. But the point is that your bilateral series have to capture the imagination of the fans. This was his opinion. And the
Correct.
players of the two countries that are playing in it and the wider cricket watching public, they should ensure that it is competitive, and that's how it always was. But nowadays, Butcher added that nobody really cares about WTC until you reach the business end of the tournament. Nobody can care less about what's going on, which team is up or down the pile. So, what's your take on that?
Nah, it's already too late then, right? So you might wake up with, I don't know, 6 months left in the WTC cycle, and then you'll see you're too far behind already.
Yeah.
Only teams which, well, teams like India and Australia who've consistently been there or thereabouts. Australia missed out in the first time by some, penalty they received at the very end.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would have been India Australia potentially again in that final. And
Yeah.
then New Zealand came up and won the trophy. That's good. India have lost twice in the final, but they've still sort of prioritized all their home series very well to win them, to give themselves a clear advantage, even in that last home series, right, where they had to beat England by at least three test wins. They did that, India, right? So when you look at all this, you see the focus is still there. So it's all about putting out a strong team. So even now, when India were losing 1-0 in South Africa, there was a lot of talk on where this is going. But India bounced back and they walked away with something to salvage from that series as well, right? So that's the whole point. Even when you are touring, you have to try and salvage one game or two. You don't let it completely be a one-sided thing. But
Yeah.
especially playing at home, you will look to maximize those points. And
Yeah.
if there are 3-day tests, it's not entirely Australia's fault, is it?
Yeah. And the modicum of intrigue that had been building in the initial stages of the WTC was, I think, slightly killed by the shifting of goalposts that happened with regards to the scoring points and the home and away format. I think a bit more consistent calculation could have, drawn Test cricket fans to actually keep a tab on how the teams are jostling up and down the table.
We will see more of innovation and we'll see more changes to the laws. But as things stand,
Yeah.
it's not bad. That's the whole
Yeah.
point for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Personally, I enjoy it because there's something up for grab in every test match.
Exactly. And look, playing a test match and winning it for the sake of itself is a good thing, right?
Yeah.
And that contributing to a series, a win, and then eventually to a bigger picture every 2 years, that is already enough intrigue for me because a test match can change from session to session, from hour to hour. So that's why
Yeah.
you are watching it as a test match fan, right? So from that perspective, that already has enough intrigue. But then if teams are not able to come with full force, that's something they are missing out on. And
Yeah, correct.
they are choosing to sort of let it sort of put it on the side. Then it's
Yeah,
unfortunate because in this case,
correct.
I really worry for the West Indian team coming back to this one here. They might even punch for a session or two, is what I'm thinking. If Australia bat first in these tests, I mean, they'll be in the ground for 2 days until Australia choose to retire, declare or whatever. So that's the sort of worry I'm really having.
Yeah, I think I'm looking forward to the contest. And just following up on what you said, I'm expecting West Indies to give them a hard fight, show the stomach for a contest. And it has been a little sad to see their gradual demise in international cricket. But West Indies do belong to that cadre of cricketers who have that war and vigor about them. So I'm hoping they can make an impact in sports, if at all.
There is always an opportunity, right? To make a name for yourself, become the next big thing. The way sort of Kyle Myers or somebody announced himself. So you can always try and score big runs away in Australia. It'll always be well respected. Even people like Tag Narayan, for example, to show he's the worthy successor to Chandrapal name and so on. So there's plenty to be had. And Kumar Roach is still there leading the attack. The spin contingent might be a bit weak, but you still have Alzaria and Kumar in fast bowling. So there's always something there. But can they punch consistently across 5 days and then across a whole series? That remains to be seen. Now, news that, you know, might affect in the coming days. One, Hampshire is confirming that they are in an investment talk with the GMR Group, which is the Delhi Capitals parent company. Do you see finally that, you know, some Indian big cricketing conglomerates might also get a foothold in English domestic circuit when it comes to, you know, county championship and so on?
Yeah, the wheel was set in motion, I think, 3 or 4 seasons ago, or maybe even back, with Indian entities buying shares in the West Indian franchise units. And from there on, we saw how that ripple effect panned out, with SA20 seeing a lot of Indian stakeholders. And now it's moving towards the English setup as well, where Hampshire have confirmed that they are fully engaged in some detailed negotiations with inventors. And the GMR Group, the co-owners of Delhi Capitals, are in advanced talks about buying shares in the parent company. So I'm looking forward to how this disinvestment happens. With Indian cricket spreading wings, it will obviously have a bearing on other conglomerates as well.
They've had a lot of stake in T20 teams everywhere, but this is the first time where a county test team, a county team might be actually impacted and what it means the moment they have a seat on the table. And England and English establishment is so particular about how the county cricket should be played and what it means within the English game itself, right? So this is going to be an interesting development. And as you say, rightly, we wait and watch on what this really means, how much they'll be involved and so on. So let's see how that goes. The last news is that a couple of stalwarts of Australian cricket, whom we've seen for years and years, have slowly sort of withdrawn from one format and the other. Sean Marsh and Aaron Finch have decided to call time on their T20 careers as well. So the Melbourne Renegades games that end the, you know, the latest edition of BBL will be their last games, they say. Maybe let's quickly ask you, any good memories when it comes to Finch and Sean Marsh you would like to quickly recall?
With Finch, it was always a funny case of him moving teams in the IPL, but obviously a very destructive cricketer. And Sean Marsh, you loved his languid, effortless stroke play and also very gritty cricketer when it came to negotiating those tough patches. Although, one of the memories as an Indian fan are obviously associated with that Jasprit Bumrah's slower delivery on the stroke of lunch.
Right.
But, yeah, I wish them all the best. And now they'll be delegating to commentary boxes or punditry.
Absolutely. So. And rightly, we wish them all the best going away into the sunset and so on. But I thought it's a contrast between these two when you look at what they've achieved. Finch is a World Cup winning Australian captain. Right. And that came out of nowhere for me simply because this guy maximized the limited amount of talent he had. I mean, he turned up at international cricket like a biffer, like a, you know, village blacksmith being able to hit the ball very hard. For him to have played a few tests, but actually having been in the Australian setup, limited over setup for a long time and eventually winning a World Cup for them, that is
outdid himself.
Right. On the other hand, if you look at Sean Marsh, it's the exact other end of the spectrum where a very talented person could not convert the talent to mean more in the longer formats, but also maybe, He's always there to score tough runs, be it for his IPL team, be it for his state team, be it for his BBL team. That's Sean Marsh, who he is. Maybe he was not able to keep himself mentally just there or thereabouts in those crucial 15, 20 minutes, half an hour period, that last ball before lunch sort of situation, what you mentioned. Nonetheless,
that's a lovely comparison, Ajit.
No, but I just felt it like that, and it makes sense. History will tell us more in 25, 30 years down the line if that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, and something that has always been associated with the Marsh brothers is a bit of hot-headedness. Because even Mitchell Marsh, I think, was called an idiot by Justin Langer when he punched his hand into a dressing room wall and injured himself during a test match.
Perfect. So okay.
Maybe you are on point when you say that there's a little bit of lack in terms of mental application when it came to converting and optimizing their talent.
Just the temperament, I suppose. We'll see if Mitch Marsh now is sort of seemed to have kicked up a gear, is able to stay there, right?
Correct, correct. But he's a late bloomer in that
That's
sense.
Okay. I mean, see, Australian cricket does encourage people who come into their own in their early 30s, but then 2 to 3, 4 years of good, even high-level cricket in tests and so on is enough. Mitchell Marsh has won World Cups as well.
Correct.
So, all right. Those are all the cricketing news and other topics that we wanted to discuss in this episode. Thanks, as always, for a lovely chat, Aryan.
You're welcome, Ajit. Always a pleasure interacting with you.
Would you like to plug any of your new upcoming blogs or other articles or other work you may be doing?
Yeah, sure. So apart from appearing on other podcasts, I also have one of my own podcasts, which is Cricket Beyond Borders, where I team up with a guy from Pakistan and the US, and we talk about the global happenings in cricket and deeper analytical dives. And this is a branch out of my cricketing work, but primarily I write features for Gorilla Cricket. You can head over to their website and roll over to the feature section, where you'll find detailed statistical analysis and match reports, features on the Indian team. And recently, in the last year, I also broadened my horizons, taking other teams into my wings. So I would urge people to read my content and provide feedback on my Twitter platform or LinkedIn. And it would be nice if I can redirect some traffic from this podcast onto my original work.
Absolutely. I recommend both the podcast as well as the written work of Aryan. It's very engaging to read and listen.
Thank you so much, Ajit.
Thank you once again from our side as well for you. You've taken the time to be on the podcast. And as always, it's been very enjoyable for me as well. We hope to have you again sometime soon. So we'll see when that opportunity arises. So we thank also all our listeners for their patronage, and we wish to have you in the upcoming episodes. We wish you all a good day, wherever you may be listening from. Goodbye.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Podcast Network.